Welcome to On Demand with Jenna Ellis. This is our AFR exclusive podcast where we do a deep dive into topics that you need to hear about from guests that you love to hear from. And, you know, we're in the context right now that America is more politically divided than it has been in generations. I mean, remember in 1776 that we just celebrated the 250th anniversary of America when Congress actually unanimously made a declaration that was, you know, this greatest complaint in the history of government systems. Can you imagine Congress doing that today unanimously? I mean, they can barely get anything even passed by a simple majority, much less unanimously. And so trust in our institutions is declining. Public discourse has become increasingly hostile, and many Americans wonder where our country is headed, and rightfully so. But what if someone has actually lived through the kind of societal collapse we often assume could never happen here? So my guest today is Guy Paul Nora, who is the author of Not on Our Watch, A Young Soldier's Warning to America. And so as a teenager, Guy survived the outbreak of the Lebanese Civil War, a conflict that tore apart families, neighborhoods, and an entire nation. Drawing from those firsthand experiences, he argues in this book that America should pay attention to the warning signs that often precede societal breakdown, including deep polarization, the loss of shared identity, and the dehumanization of political opponents. We're certainly seeing all that today. So today I want to talk about his remarkable story of survival, what he believes Americans can learn from Lebanon's experience, and why he thinks preserving both our constitutional republic and our civic culture requires vigilance long before a crisis begins. And we're in the middle of the crisis. But Guy, welcome to the program. It's so great to have you.
Thank you so much, and it's a pleasure to be on your show, Jenna.
Yeah, so your personal story, let's start with that. You were only 15 years old when the Lebanese Civil War began. So how does a teenager mentally transition from carrying school books to carrying a rifle?
in my case, I was probably little premature for my age as far as, paying attention to the environment around me. And, these things don't happen overnight. So for the last couple of years, so this was 75. So, 73, 74, 75, a lot of bad things were happening around the country, the same way I can say that they're happening here now. And in my case, I decided that even though I was young, I lied to my parents about going to a Boy Scout camp, and I actually went to commando camp all through 74. And, of course, in 75, unfortunately, the war started. So I was prepared from that perspective. And in my case, it was just really defending my neighborhood, my people, my religion. It was a very clear story for me. I didn't have to do much thinking about it.
Wow. And, looking back now as an adult, you say that there were warning signs that that you observed and that America should recognize before the violence ever begins. So take us back kind of before that time and what the warning signs were that led up to this civil war.
Yeah, so Jenna, it's very interesting. It comes in two ways now that I live here and I've been here my whole life, and I love this country and I studied here. So there are two things you look at, and in my case, that's what it was. There are kind of, if you want to call, clinical / intellectual signs that tells you that something is going on. And you mentioned some of them, polarization, social division, not inviting your family over for Thanksgiving because how they voted, political dysfunction, erosion of the rule of law, assassinations. Again, this is your intellectual list, right? We can make 10. In my case, it's this much as it is a feeling, a pattern recognition. Been there, done that, seen it. I see it. I see how people talk about each other. I see what people say about each other. I see how we a lot of people, you know, the whole demonization thing is very interesting. If you can dehumanize somebody, then you can do awful things to them. If you can go ahead and say that because somebody did not take a vaccine, I can take their children away from them, I think we're moving in that direction. So to me, I could just see it on both sides, if you want, the emotional side and the intellectual side. And I see it, you know, when you're me, you see it every day. And yeah, it's pattern recognition.
Yeah. And do you think that one follows the other? Like, does emotional precede intellectual? Or how have you seen that actually function in broader society? I mean, because obviously there are some isolated individuals that for whatever reason, all, you know, think political violence is okay, or they dehumanize. But to get to a point where it's culturally normative and accepted is a whole different thing.
Yeah, so I think it's actually the intellectual analytical goes first, right? You know, you look at us as a country, you look at, you know, one of the saddest things that I think had happened a year ago, which was the assassination of Charlie Kirk. Mm-hmm. Assassinations are a sign of the falling apart of a civilized society. You know, people don't do that. Political unrest and questioning elections. People always like to say that President Trump questioned the 2020 election. Yes, he did. But let's not forget that in 2016, we were bombarded with the Russian hoax stories. So when both sides are beginning to not accept the results of elections, we have a problem because our whole institutions are actually shaking. When people criticize the Supreme Court, you know, you saw yesterday, you know, everybody's scared about being on the Supreme Court. That's not a good thing either. So you can kind of pick up on these patterns everywhere you go, and you see them. And then for me, what follows is I start paying a lot more attention to rhetoric. And social media is not helping. But then you start seeing the rhetoric. And the rhetoric is now, I think, as bad as it gets. It's probably being influenced by outside parties, you know, people who want us harm, countries outside of the United States. And we're falling for it.
Yeah. And what's really sad, and I think one of the cautionary tales that you're describing, is that this isn't just delegitimizing institutions from the lefts and the socialist communists who clearly want to undermine the U.S. Constitution, our civil society, and obviously, you know, the American experiment as a whole. But even the distrust in institutions is coming from the new right as well. And so for vastly different reasons, but ultimately kind of the same conclusion, even if some distrust in our institutions is warranted, the response to that is not, simply a civil unrest and basically a revolution. And so how does all of this point and this political disagreement become then moral hatred that then both sides sort of justify into their version of a revolution?
Great question. So you know, first, just so you know, my book gets very poignant and very descriptive, because when people read it, I want them to tell themselves, I don't want to be in this position. I don't want my children to be in this position. I don't want my brother to be in this position, and et cetera. So I try to really emphasize that side, because war is ugly. Everybody knows that, but people kind of tend to forget. But to answer your question, it's what I call the echo chamber, right? So, obviously, you know, I strongly lean conservative. I'm a Christian. I fought for Christianity in 75. So that's not something you just give up on. What happens is that one side, and this is normally, we saw it in the Spanish Civil War, you see it in a lot of civil wars, one side keeps pushing the envelope, okay? You try to kill the president. You actually assassinate a very, very important figure for our side. Some lunatic goes and kills the CEO. Every day you're on the street waving flags and complaining about this amazing country you live in. So that side has already made their view well known. What is not being seen yet is the other side. And I'm not referring to the extreme, whatever they call the extreme right, because I don't see the extreme right doing anything right now in the United States that has anything to do with pushing civil war. But it's the rest of us, right? It's the rest of us. God forbid something bad happens to somebody we really love and care. What are we going to do? Are we going to get upset and pick up our guns and go after the side that has been provoking for the last 2, 3, 4 years, or are we going to have a serious debate and a serious discussion with arms behind that? Meaning that we're going to talk about this, but if we don't get anywhere, we're going towards a civil war. So I think these are, this is to answer your question. You know, we need to be very, very aware of the dynamics that are occurring, and we cannot put enough influence on outside parties that want to do this. I think China wants to create problems in our country because that just works in their favor. I think Iran can, and they will, and they probably have, which is why social media is so polarized. And my concern is always, when does their rhetoric become action? Because once it becomes action, then it's a lot more dangerous. And then it's up to us to stop it. And my book is about, don't even go there. We're not even going to think about it.
Yeah. And, and Americans often say, well, it could never happen here and the rhetoric won't go to that great of extent. But I mean, we've seen that already in our nation's very young history. We've seen, several wars and actual conflicts that have been engaged over politics and, some of these other issues. And yet it seems like, and then, of course, obviously in world history, and we're talking about the Lebanese civil war that you've engaged in as well. And so yet in some segment of the right, they're actually pushing for civil war as if that is the goal that we should be angling toward, because that's the actual moral solution. So in your experience, what's the biggest misconception Americans have about civil wars, how they actually begin, and whether this is actually in our best interest as the reasonable solution? I mean, our founders clearly didn't think that. I mean, that was their last resort, not the first, well, we just need to take up our guns and, go literally maybe storm the Capitol.
Yeah. So the answer to your question about some people on the right, I think it stems from a couple of things. First of all, I would say that maybe over the last 10, 15 years, the right has been on the defensive when it comes to a lot of these things. Remember, the right is not rioting outside of Portland, and they're not rioting in Minneapolis, and they're not rioting in New York, and they're not from the sea to the, from the river to the sea. None of that is the right. So there is a segment of the right that thinks these are just spoiled children / trained elements, which, if there were a civil war, the rights, we love our guns, most of us practice using them. So there's a feeling on the right to explain that particular faction is basically saying, we can win. And if we can win, we might as well get it done and put this behind us. So the problem with that thinking is that, at what cost do you win? Do you win at the cost of killing your cousin? Do you win at the cost of going against your nieces and nephews and perhaps having them kill you, or vice versa? There's a huge cost to civil war. And a lot of times people don't realize the amazing pain that comes along with that. Because even though you and I happen to be on the same side, and I'm confident with my family and your family and your friends, I bet you somewhere in your family there's a cousin who's a left winger who might pick up arms on the other side. And that's somebody you grew up with. It could be somebody you went to school with. It could be somebody you worked with. So it's not that simple to say, hey, Jay, we're the right, we're going to pick up our guns and, you know, we're going to get this done. So we just have to be really, really, really careful before we get to that level. And unfortunately, the way this works is there are lots of random incidents around all the intellectual things I told you. And then there's one day, there's just like one big event. And that big event changes everything. And that's in the book, actually. So you have this growing tension. And I would say in the United States, it's probably as high, again, I've seen people tell me it's as high as it was before the Civil War. Tension, 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 tension. And then it just takes one event that kind of changes everything. And before you know it, one side of the road is you, the other side of the road is them. And we don't want to go there.
Yeah. And those are some really sobering realities that I think a lot of people on both sides who are more of the ideologues maybe don't contemplate some of those realities and the costs, of course. And that's, of course, the founders here in America did count those costs and they lived them and experienced them to a very great extent. And you mentioned as well, Guy, that social media rewards outrage. And I find that the social proof of is, you know, one of the greatest mechanisms that's being harnessed by both sides to have this perception of an outrage mob and the perception of consensus, when in reality, a lot of this is being driven now by foreign influence, by bots, by a whole host of things that you can't even really tell whether it's a true version of what and kind of a weather vane of where each side is actually looking and what their stance is. But it definitely is a mechanism that's being used to push more people to join a mob, even if it's a fabricated mob. And there's a lot of danger in that. And so how much of this is perhaps unique in our digital age to spawn this kind of thirst for civil war that is genuinely unhealthy and maybe driven actually by people we wouldn't otherwise follow if we really knew who was behind it?
Yeah, I think it's from your side, I think that's a very, very smart catch and a very smart, of your perceiving this. You see what In every civil war, and if you go back in history, you study them. There's always a group of people that will want to be the provocateurs that cause it, and whether they're outside influence or sometimes they're an inside influence because they want to bring the system down from the inside. Social media has only given those people a louder microphone. You know, what you're seeing in social media now, I bet you 100 years ago in the Civil War in Spain, you were seeing inside churches and inside Communist Party rallies and inside labor union meetings. It was the same exact echo chamber, but it happened to be much more physical. So social media is just an extension of that. And there were people inside those rallies. For instance, you know, if you were, again, I use the Spanish Civil War a lot because I think it's, you have so many more examples. Of course, I use my war as well. But you know, so the Russians, the Soviets, would be inside those labor meetings in Spain, and they would just push the envelope. And they would say, you know, anarchy and communism, and let's get rid of the right wing and the king. And then, of course, on the other side, you would have the, you know, Nazi Germany saying to the side that they wanted to support. You know, Bolshevik is the worst thing in the world. We're here to help you. Anything you need, you know, we shall support you. So that's outsiders. But a lot of times you have insiders that want to bring the system in from the, bring the system down from the inside. And I would argue that what I've seen recently, the last, I don't know, week from the DSA, is that's what they're telling us. They're pretty clear. They're not hiding their intentions. They want to bring this down from the inside. So what does that mean? That means in a time of civil war, I was telling a friend of mine this yesterday, in general, the thing I just want you to think about, you know, the rest of the day or the rest of the week, whatever, is that imagine a street where you live, just a street, regular street, and imagine the one side of the street is you and the other of the street is them. It's just that simple. Overnight, it becomes that way. And imagine someone in the middle, agents from outside countries, shooting at both sides. And then before you know it, what was a 3-hour ceasefire is now back into a big battle. And I was telling my friend yesterday, I remember this happening. I remember sitting on the front thinking they're done with their prayers. They're going to leave us alone the rest of the night. You know, we can catch our breath. And next thing I know, from like maybe half a mile down the street, I would see somebody shooting. And I'd look and I'd see, oh my gosh, they're shooting at both sides. And that's how you start it. So all you have to do is to create this, is to start this. And then to answer your other question, which was normal people who say it's not going to happen, well, guess what? My parents were those normal people that said it wouldn't happen. My parents would go to the other side of town and go to bars and restaurants and dinners. They'd go to the Muslim side of town and come back and say, oh, everything's fine. There's no problem. Don't worry about it. And I'd be saying, you guys don't understand. The other side of town is now pretty much enemy. And we are on this side, and all they want to do is come over and take over. And until, honestly, the day the war started, my parents were everything is going to be fine. It won't happen here. We're civilized. We've learned our lessons, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, you've got to be very careful, you know, even in these things. And my book is actually written for people like my parents who were ignoring the reality in front of their faces. I'm not asking them to take sides. I'm asking them to come on our watch and stop the craziness from happening.
Yeah, and you know, so well said that the rhetoric that's generated on social media is basically firing at both sides, and it would be wise for the conservatives and especially the Christians to be wise about this and to realize that they may be influenced just from a different standpoint and a different set of emotional prodding than the left. But ultimately, if the outside influences are influencing both sides to go to the same place, which is civil war, civil unrest, just for cross purposes, then that's ultimately the goal. And we need to not be puppets in all of that. And it's very interesting how, you know, so many of us would say, if we think of ourselves at all as intellectual and fair and even open-minded, which are supposed to be virtues in this culture, and biblically speaking as well, we should be in pursuit of truth, that we evaluate ideas on their own merit when really, if we're honest, we are influenced by a lot of ideas and what we listen to, the culture around us, and we have to, on purpose, be influenced first and foremost by the Bible and by the things of God and compare and contrast every thought, take every thought captive, and to make sure that even political ideas align with what Scripture says so that we aren't advanced in our thinking by these social proofs. And so how would you encourage people who are currently in this country seeing all of the political unrest, frankly, seeing the political violence, seeing everything that's going on in this culture, to not be so quick to the solution just being an actual physical conflict, but some other solution that's practical and more morally justified at this juncture? And I'm not saying that civil war is never morally justified, to be clear to the audience. I do think our revolution was morally justified, but it was the last ultimate possibility when every other alternative had been exhausted.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. In my business in venture capital, you know, when you have a problem in your company, the first thing you do is you have to define the problem. So I think a lot of this is actually introducing to the American public the fact that we do have a problem, because unlike you and me, you know, we pay attention to everything that's going on, and consequently we're always way, way ahead of someone. But I've made it a study since I ran for governor to always understand what I would call is the large middle. That's your left, center left, and your center right, and they don't follow like you and I do. You know, they're out there living their lives. You know, they probably have been watching the World Cup the last couple of weeks. They watch sports. They take their kids to soccer practice. They work really hard. They pay their taxes. They go to church. They go bowling. They're not paying attention to the things that you and I are. So they wake up one day, if we let it happen, they wake up and they're probably the most surprised at where we ended up. And I think our job is to make sure they catch this sooner rather than later so that we never get there. But to your point of Christian, it was probably one of my hardest things, Jenna, was to, you know, I'm educated as a Christian. I go to Christian schools. It's all about Christ's message. And then here I am with an AK-47 in my hand. To me, that was probably the biggest dilemma. But like you mentioned, you know, sometimes that's the only solution. And you need to stand up for your people. And I hope it never happens here to our Christians in the United States. But they also have to be very, very aware that we are under attack, even in the United States. I mean, you know, I get goosebumps when I watch, 25,000 Muslims praying on the streets. I mean, I've been there. I've seen that. I know exactly what that means. That is a very strong sign of dominance. And then I see that they are allied with the extreme left, Mamdani, and I've seen that movie again. Exact same movie. It's dominance. It's the left wanting to blow things up and using the extremist Muslims to get it done. That simple. That's a very simple play. And it's been used over the last, it started out with Lebanon, but it's being used in Europe right now, Belgium, France, England, you name it. And it's beginning to get used in the United States, New York Exhibit A.
Yes. Yeah. And this is really scary. And this is exactly why your book is so timely, that Americans need to recognize some of these warning signs and understand that, you know, we are being pushed maybe into this thought process that isn't organic. It's not necessarily a move that we should be making morally and biblically right now. And even though some, I think, have been taken captive by some of these social proofs, or they're just buying into it for, other reasons, that doesn't necessarily mean that this perceived consensus, even on the right, is the morally justified path. And so for you, Guy, then in this cautionary tale, and again, the book is Not on Our Watch. You can get that in pre-order now. It's from Simon & Schuster. You can go to simonandschuster.com or anywhere books are sold. It's called Not on Our Watch. And what is then the solution, and what would you say to people on kind of this new right that are saying, well, we don't have trust in our institutions, we don't have election integrity, we don't have leaders that actually care about wins and policy wins, and we're seeing the rise of socialism in this country. We can't just sit back and talk. So if not civil war, what is the solution?
I always Your question is exactly what I tell people when they come to me with problems. Again, I was a venture capitalist, so people always come in and say, hey, we have this problem, ABC, our clinical trials didn't work, or we can't get enough patients, or the science is not. I always say, well, you've defined the problem, can you please solve it? And I am now at the stage where I just want to define the problem. I will put it in the hands of the millions of well-meaning, intelligent, constitutionally savvy Americans to come up with things, and I'll definitely work with them on them when the time comes. But for now, this is just the warning. If I do have a warning now, also the problem with these situations is that they snowball. So let's not do the snowball effect. One person gets shot in Minneapolis doesn't mean we have to go to war. Let's just think about this for a second, and let's just understand that we don't want to go there, and let's be very, very careful of how quickly this goes from 0 to 100. So that's my first, but I do want to answer your question. I think once people start hopefully talking about the book, take it for granted, get concerned about it, we have some of the most intelligent people in this country, and we have some of the biggest problem solvers in this country, and I think they have to start thinking about what do we do constitutionally, what do we do logistically, how do we turn down the tension. I mean, what if you and I next year said something as Christians and made an announcement, in October, bad timing, by the way, because we're going to have a pretty tough midterm election. But let's just say we make an announcement that says, please, 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 everybody who has uninvited people for the way they voted for Thanksgiving, reinvite them. We beg you to just have them back. Let's start like we used to in the old days. Let's not talk about politics. Just have grandma over there, have Uncle Sam who voted the wrong way, in your opinion. Have Thanksgiving with them again. Just, mm-hmm. Reconnect. Your best friend my best friend gave up on me because I worked on the president's campaign in 24. What if my best friend, or I call him or he calls me and he says, you know what, let's put this aside and let's go back to where we've been the last 30 years as best friends. Maybe it takes us and people like you to say, let's be Christians first, and let's fight this with love first and foremost, because this gentleman is telling us there's an issue, and he seems to kind of know what happened, and he's seen it, and he's been there, and he's very articulate about it. So let's just, these are some of the ways I would try to work on this, Jenna. It takes one heart at a time. And guess what? The other side, the devil works a lot faster than we do. It's just how it is, and I think we just need to. For me, it's define the issue, and leave it up to the most incredibly intelligent, aware people in the world, which are the American people, to kind of themselves decide. We're not doing this again. Not on our watch. The moms, the dads, the cousins, the families, the grandparents, everybody saying, no, not on our watch. Social media, I'm turning you off. Unhappy results with elections, too bad. Figure it out, folks. Political dysfunction, either you fix it or we'll fix it for you, we the American people. And then just leave the violence and a war to the last absolute. Again, I only had to pick up a gun because they were going to take over my neighborhood. Otherwise, I would have waited. Mm-hmm. So,
Yeah. And, you know, this is a great reminder of why the family matters and everything that goes wrong in our civil government, whether it's policy, whether it's political discourse, the dehumanization, all of this can be solved if we go back to the biblical definition of the family and what that means to actually love one another and to bear one another's burdens. I mean, all of the one another's that we see across scripture, not just for the nuclear family, but also for our church family and for our neighbors as well. And so, you know, there are so many statistics about, and I've talked about this on the radio side for regular listeners who know that there are so many statistics about how young people are choosing to remove quote unquote toxic people from their lives. And that means not resolving some of these issues and looking past some of the disagreements, or maybe even some of the hurts or other things, and to say, but we are all still made in the image of God, and therefore it's our obligation to love you, not necessarily obviously like affirm their lifestyle if it's sinful, you know, all of those things, but to genuinely show all of those one another's. And if we did that more, then we couldn't dehumanize the people that we're breaking bread with. I mean, what a timely reminder that our ultimate hope isn't in any earthly nation, but when we're entrusted with this responsibility to seek justice, love our neighbors, love our family, faithfully steward the freedoms we've been given, that starts with us and not just being so ready to go to conflict, but seeking first that resolution, maybe before revolution. And so, Guy, thank you so much for your perspectives, for sharing your personal story, and this reminder that liberty isn't self-sustaining. It requires courage and virtue and people who are willing to defend both truth and one another. I mean, we need to come together as Americans. And so the book is Not on Our Watch, A Young Soldier's Warning to America. Be sure to pick up a copy. And Guy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure, and I hope to meet you in person one day.
Yes, I would love that. Well, we'll have to hopefully arrange that sometime. This would be a great conversation with my friend Alex McFarland, who does a lot of these that are called Conversations That Matter. So you guys are hearing it on the podcast right now. I'm going to recommend that he book you for that event. And if he does, I'll be there. And that would be great. And I'd love to hear that conversation as well. So thanks so much again, Guy. And you've been listening to On Demand. And these are great conversations. And so a lot of these interviews are recommendations from listeners, obviously from my great producers as well. But if you have a topic or a guest that you'd like us to address on the podcast, you can always reach me and my team, Jenna at AFR.net, and I'll see you again on Friday.